I just can't have any social life right now.
Don't worry about it. We're just having coffee. We'll be antisocial.
Hello and welcome to another Damn Fine Espresso. I'm once again here to talk about culture of any kind, whether that's books or films, or in this case, really, it's games. We've got a guest for you this month, namely Johanna Pirka. Hello, Johanna.
Hello, hello, and thanks so much for the invitation. I can't wait to talk a lot about games.
No problem. Thank you very much for being here. Now, Johanna is an Austrian computer scientist. She's a science communicator and a game designer. She works at Graz University of Technology and the Technical University of Munich. Her focus is on games research, virtual reality and data science. So I'm definitely very excited to talk to her about these things. And she works on educating on and doing advocacy for video games. Johanna has won various awards for her work, and she was listed on the Forbes 30 Under 30 Europe list in the category Science and Healthcare in 2018. The main reason I'm talking to her today is that last year, in 2025, she published a book called The Game Is On, which is about how games and gaming revolutionized our world. So again, welcome and congratulations on last year's book release.
Thank you so much. Like, writing a book is a little bit more difficult than I had expected it to be, but it was a fun thing. It was a book. It's not going to win the Literature Nobel Prize. I have already spoiled that, but it's something which is coming from my heart, because I constantly feel sometimes almost attacked of being a gamer, even though for me gaming is such a positive thing. And that's why I thought I want to write a book, take away some of those stereotypes and hopefully a little bit the bias. So this was the original idea.
I've also been gaming for a couple of decades, and I think in Europe we're still probably 10 years or more behind, let's say, England or the US, where I think it's become much more accepted as also a cultural form and art form. But I think in Europe you still have these very kind of old-fashioned ideas sometimes, you know, the kind that parents sometimes have, you know, don't play so much, do something proper.
Yes, right? So it's absolutely okay to watch hours TV, but you cannot play an hour of a video game, right?
Absolutely, very much. So let's perhaps just start with the origin story. How did you become a gamer? And what are the kind of games and systems and gaming experiences that made you as a gamer?
That's a very good question. So, like, I always try to tell this one point of my memory where I think this is actually one of the most important memories I have, because it is my first memory on sitting on a in front of a PC and playing a video game. This was when I was probably 3 or 4 years old, and I couldn't write or read yet, but I knew exactly what buttons I need to push or what I need to enter on my keyboard to actually start my favorite game on the DOS machine back then of my father. And this was, I don't know, like I'm being asked quite often how I got it all into computer science, because computer science is still a very male-dominated field. And especially like when I grew up, there was not a lot of female computer science students. However, I figured that I was never scared of this machine, because for me, it was always this memory that if I go to this giant dark machine, like, okay, for us, it was great, but it would open up those beautiful creative worlds. So for me, a PC, this was always something super creative, something super colorful. So I was never scared. And my favorite game back then, and the first game I remember playing, was Prince of Persia. Did you play this one?
I played it. I never finished it. It was, at the time, it was a bit too difficult for me. I then played the later games, you know, like Sands of Time and those. But the original, I played it, but it beat me. I didn't beat it.
But it's quite interesting, because John Melchior, who created this game, also has a whole diary recently published as a book, how he created that game back then, like with a lot of photographs and the design process. Because back then, developing games was so much more difficult. And this process really shows you how creative the entire game development process is, not only from the art side and from the game design side, but they also needed to be super creative when it came to tech, right? So as I hear, it was not easy to create games. So if you wanted to have fancy animations, you would need to come up with a fancy system and a fancy tech.
Absolutely. I mean, my impression is also that in the early days, it was pioneers doing things that had never been done. It's a bit like, you know, cinema in the early years, you know, more than 100 years ago. Because these days, I think a lot of it is codified. A first-person shooter, you know, how you control it. You know, this button shoots, this stick makes you move. But at the very beginning, they were basically making up an art form. They were making up a whole system of signs and ways of doing it. And I agree with you. It's definitely fascinating. I sometimes miss the kind of the almost the frontier feel of early gaming, because you still have that, I think, in indie gaming, but it's definitely something that if you look at early games, some of them are so crazy and out there, and some of them didn't work at all, obviously, but it was a strange world to discover.
But you already mentioned something so nice. This is what I love about indie games, that they still are able to dare things, that they're still able to try to innovate. And you, like every couple of years, I would say, you still get one of those indie game phenomena, which comes up with such a crazy new mechanic where you thought, oh, wow, you can still invent a whole new genre or a whole new game design technique.
Absolutely. So, as you said, you played from a very early age onwards. From your book, I get the impression that you played on computers, but then also on consoles, that you didn't have this either a console or a computer, that basically it's the games that count. Is that correct? Was it like that?
Yes, I can remember like my first memories are certainly on a computer. Then I think my first console thing, which was the handheld, was the Game Boy, the classics. Of course, Pokemon and like Mario, of course. And the first console, which also really, really, really touched me, was the Nintendo 64. I didn't have the earlier ones. But the 64, then like immersing myself into those three realms with Super Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time, still one of the most important games. I don't know if you're a Nintendo person or...
I mean, I was always aware of it. You couldn't not be aware of Nintendo, of course. And I wanted, as a teenager, I wanted a Game Boy, but I couldn't afford it. I think my first Nintendo console was then a Wii. You know, basically that's when so many people got into consoles. Before that, it was always computers, you know, C64, Amiga, then PC. And consoles, I really only started playing on consoles, I think, with the PlayStation 2 when Guitar Hero came out. Since then, I've kind of been playing in parallel on computers, still mostly computers, but also some on consoles. Now, for you, was gaming first and foremost a solitary thing, or was that also something you did with friends? You talked about it with friends. Was it communal?
This is so funny because, like, again, that's why for me it was so important to write this book, because those are the typical things people say about gamers. So of course, they need to be male and they need to be super young and they're all by themselves in the basements. But I feel like most of the gamers I know, and I would, and again, also myself, we love playing games with other people. We love to play games together. And also my first memories, like when I just mentioned Pokemon, I was sitting outside in the garden with with the neighbor, and we were exchanging the Pokemons. So this was so lovely. Or when I think of, what was the name of this game? Worms?
Yeah, exactly.
this is so good, right? We were talking about this creative art form, and Worms is, that's a fun one, yeah. So for everyone who does not know Worms, this is like this game where you basically have this tiny army of worms and you need to defeat the other worms. And they have so absurd mechanics, absurd weapons. And yeah, and I can remember playing this a lot with a friend together on the same PC. So you were taking turns. And then last but not least, in the world of MMOs, I was a Guild Wars 2 player. So for me, it was always very connected to friends, making friends, playing with friends, or also working in a global environment, right? It's so lovely to spend time online together with people, playing a game, playing FIFA once a month together and just talk and play.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I'm more of a solitary gamer. I play a lot of, for instance, RPGs. That's changed a bit, but I think a lot of them usually were single player games. But especially over the last couple of years, I've found that gaming is a great way of hanging out with others that live in other countries. Like, for instance, I've also written about this on the Damn Fine Cup of Culture, playing walkabout mini golf in virtual reality with friends around the world, just hanging out, you know, playing mini golf badly, having a chat. At its best, it is a very social activity. And I think it's also that's one where one of its great strengths is, especially now with technologies like virtual reality. that it is really, you can hang out with others in a virtual place. But that's also true, as you said, for MMOs, for these large online role-playing games, stuff like World of Warcraft. Now, as I said, you're also a researcher. You're not just a gamer, but you do research also on games. So how did you become a researcher who works on games? Was that pretty clear early on in your career?
Not at all. So I still think, like, and sometimes I try to reflect a little bit how I became this person I am now. Like, if you would ask a five-year-old girl, what do you want to become when you're grown up? So the typical answers would be a teacher, or the things the parents are doing, or maybe the things like a policeman, or some things they saw on TV. Because it's so difficult to know exactly where the future will bring us. So for me, it was not clear at all. And all the things I did like did not make sense for any of those typical future careers. So it was very difficult for me actually to find my path. But in the end, it makes so much sense. And like, that's what I try. Like when I talk to young people, I would never ask them, what do you want to become once you're grown up? I would always try to rather ask, like, what are the things you like and enjoy doing now? What do you think you're good at? And when you think, like, I loved the creative endeavors in creating virtual worlds. I loved working with these worlds, misusing them for other, for just meeting friends, or like I created tiny games for myself, sometimes to make decisions, or also sometimes about myself, just for me, not like nobody else ever played them. Or I loved playing like solving puzzles, playing logical puzzles, solving puzzles. And like, if you combine all of those things, you have the researcher, you have an academic, you have someone who loves to explore. Again, but I would not have dared to say that I'm a computer science professor or with a focus on games and virtual worlds. So yeah, this is sort of, yeah, how was my way there? Exploring and then just like finding my niche and just also daring to do the things which many people did not have the best opinions about. Does this make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I could imagine, as I said, I think Europe is still a bit more conservative in many respects when it comes to games. And academia can, of course, be very conservative. Was there a lot of resistance to you going in this direction?
I felt it was polarizing. So I felt like there are two sides. So some sides who are super supportive, really see, wow, this is something fresh, this is innovative, very supportive. And then the other side who sees this, it's just a game. It's just like, you're just fooling around. You're a fool. So it's between those two worlds. And so sometimes it's difficult to ignore those not so nice loud voices. But I think those are the things we have to do in order to still achieve the things we want to achieve.
I would imagine that now that you've had quite a career, has this improved, or do you still get some of these doubters?
That's interesting. So like, I think like the people who do know me and my path per se do have it took a lot of explaining sometimes, but also by now have hopefully more or less respect of my field and what I'm doing. But especially in the realm of computer science, sometimes it's difficult to constantly explain what the main research is about and why this is important. This was probably also one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book and make just some points a little bit more transparent. So for instance, we are living in this AI driven world these days, and many of those systems have been trained on video games or video games environments. One of the Nobel Prize winners of chemistry last year used to be an AI programmer in video games, in the video game Black and White by Peter Molyneux. And honestly, like, even though it's not related at all, so there was no Nobel Prize, of course, for the game development, but just seeing that someone who also was so fascinated by the power of games in the end won a Nobel Prize, this was for me so motivating to see. And yeah, so sometimes I'm still fighting, honestly, but I feel it's a fight worth fighting for.
So I think this is a good point to talk about the book in earnest. So the book, as I said, is called The Game Is On. And you've basically separated it into four parts: play, create, rethink, and reflect. And I think I would like to talk just about all of these parts one by one in a bit more detail. play. In that part, you basically talk about the diversity of games and about games as art and culture. You know, there's this, I think, very often very frustrating and probably also a bit boring conversation about are games art? As I said, it is a bit of a boring question, but I'll ask you anyway. Would you say games are art? And if so, what do you mean by it? I think the second part is probably the more interesting one.
So like in any other medium, like whether we're talking about games, whether we're talking about books or movies, there are things which are super valuable, super artistic, coming from artistic expressions, trying to convey it, interesting philosophical thoughts, interesting ideas, and some who were designed to for monetization and business and so forth. So I think this is like the start. Like I want to give a little bit of a heads up there. So when I'm saying video games are art, I would not say all of the video games, but because not all of them were created with this purpose. However, if you look a little bit closer, let's say one of the AAA games. If you think of a game like Assassin's Creed, this is such a huge game where thousands of people are being part of the development process. If you think and just imagine this world of Assassin's Creed, and you find interesting pieces, 3D objects within this world, the architecture of the buildings, especially in Assassin's Creed, it's a very interdisciplinary project. So also historians were involved in developing that and trying to make it as immersive as possible for the given time. Then there is someone who created the story, who wrote all the dialogues, who created the world building, the story building around that. And there is someone who created the music playing in the background. And if you also take just those things per themselves, you have works in literature, you have works in music, you have works in classical 2D, 3D art forms. So also the single parts of video games are often very artistic from extremely talented people in there. So that's why, for instance, for last year, if I remember correctly, I think it was last year, also the composer for Assassin's Creed won a Grammy, just to demonstrate also those pieces as certainly extremely well thought through and artistic. And then there are video games. Here I'm thinking especially of indie games, where the game itself conveys such an interesting new concept in a very artistic way and so forth. So if you would ask me, are video games art? Yes, there's so many game parts within video games in different disciplines, from different artistic disciplines being brought together in these masterpieces. But there's also single games which just demonstrate single concepts in a very different way. Are all games art? Probably not, but many of them were created with this background and with this focus.
You want to perhaps mention a couple of titles of especially indie games that you think are especially interesting in that respect, also for our listeners, especially the ones who don't perhaps play all that much and, you know, would like to have a couple of tips of what to look for?
I feel Journey is a very good and early example. I don't know, have you played that one?
I have, yeah. I've even introduced non-gaming friends to it, and it worked really well for them because it is, in a way, it's, as a game, it's very simple. As the title says, it's a journey. You're traveling towards a goal, towards this mountain, and you encounter others. Also, it's a very non-combative game. It's a very non-aggressive game, which again appeals to non-gamers. So yeah, I definitely see why you would mention that one.
I also feel like I always try to think of games which have an easy access, I feel Journey is like one of those. From a philosophical point of view, I really loved Stanley's Parable. This is super interesting. This was developed by mainly one person, and it cannot spoil too much. It's also very simple to play. It's very easy to start. You're in this office area, and I don't want to give away too much. It's very philosophical. You need to find a way out, but it's not that easy as you might think it is. The Stanley Parable, but it comes with this meta commentary on games. And so this is like two games which are really coming from very different perspectives. Sometimes Dear Esther is mentioned. I found this very interesting. It was not particularly my type of game, but I can see why it has quite a fan base. It's narrative walking. I think it like got this lovely title also of walking simulator, because there's always discussion, when is a game really a game and when is it still rather movie with where you just are able to turn to the left or turn to the right and make almost no choices yourself. But again, it's you walk on this island, and in the background, the story is being told to you. So it's also super experimental, but also very, very interesting.
I mean, as you say in the book, it's games are extremely diverse. The kind of experiences you can have are extremely different. And I think the examples you give already kind of speak to that.
Yeah, exactly. And there's one, I just forgot the name, about a puzzle game going back and forth in the pictures. You probably don't know what I'm talking about, right? Maybe later during this episode, I'll come back with the name. Goro Goa. That's the name of the game I was thinking about. Sorry. But this is really lovely. I'm so much in love with this game because it comes with this hand-drawn panels. It was also created by only one person. And you would wander from frame to frame. It's a puzzle game. It's not really easy puzzles, so you have to think. But every time you solve one of those puzzles, it's like, wow, it's mind-blowing. And he worked so many years on that game, so he saved money from his back-then job. And then once he had saved enough money, he spent all his time only developing this game and developing his vision. And it's just such a pretty, for me, really perfect game. You can play it on mobile phones as well, Goro Goa. But like, I'm always very drawn to also shorter games. This is like one of the other things people tend to think of games. It's always such a waste of time. But many of the games I play, this is like watching one movie. Or sometimes like also the bigger games, which were very story heavy, some of them would last 8 hours. And I feel this is like a couple of evenings where I can immerse myself into those worlds. And again, some of those games would last an hour or two. And this is like one evening I love reading a book, another evening I love playing my video games and having this experience.
I think you've also made games yourself, right?
Yeah, so I was at some point in the games industry. I worked for one of those AAA companies, EA, back then, many, many, many years ago. And then I got into really this world of indie developing. And there my start was in game jams. Game jams is for me one of the most important things in the world, I would say. And this really made me, had a lot of impact on the person I am these days. And what is a game jam? A game jam is an event where you would work together with people you might not even know before. Most of the time it's 3, 4, 5 people. And again, like developing games is so interdisciplinary. So you need someone in the perfect scenario. You have someone who creates the art, someone who programs. This was me in that case. Someone who makes music, someone who creates the story, and someone who thinks of the level design, of the game design, the mechanics. So it's a very interdisciplinary field. And you have 48 hours to work on that. And this was my first experience. I was back then in the US. I was studying in Boston that very time, I think 2012. And I didn't know a lot of people. And then I saw in the event space that one of those global game jams is happening. And I thought, I'm just going to sign up and see how this will turn out. And it was so pretty. It was like working together with strangers from the start of an idea to a first really fun, interesting prototype. This is so rewarding. And this is actually also, I think, how a lot of my journey started, to really try to push this interdisciplinary, creative group works more and more.
You also talk in your book about the innovative potential of games. I mean, you've talked about how games basically as being technology and art combined. Obviously, that combination, how to combine it best, will involve some innovation. But where do you see the greatest innovative potential in games these days?
I love thinking of a technology or a method and then just putting it into an entirely different world, into a different discipline. And if you think of tools, for instance, originally developed to create games. Creating games, what does this mean? The tools like game engines help us as developers to create those crazy complex 3D worlds, make them interactive, make them, creating games is extremely complex. So everything needs to work. It needs to be like, if I click something, it needs to react. If I walk there with a character, there needs to be a collision. There is physics, there's audio play. So it comes with so many interesting, complex technological features and all built in a game engine. That's a tool we're using, what is called, which is free to use for everyone. So what else could you do with this outside of games? How could this be interesting for the automobile industry, for instance, to rethink how, for instance, customers are seeing how their future car might look like, how to use it in the health sector to make training more interesting, how to use it in educational spaces, to make, for instance, physics experiments free to use for everyone. That's why I'm saying, like, if it takes something and you just put it into a very different context, there can be so much innovation. And this is what I always saw in the games industry, that for me, it was always like looking into a glass ball. I hope this is in English, like looking into the future. And because there are so many interesting technologies are coming from the games industry, whether it's the GPUs, which we know now very important, not only for mobile phones, but also for AI, but also things like the game engines, pushing forward tools like virtual reality, augmented reality. There's so much to learn this field.
When I listen to you talking, I also think, you know, yes, we're talking about games, but I think also the act of creating games or making something out of games, there's something playful to that, as you said, working with an engine. I mean, it is difficult, it is work, but it's probably easier these days to play around with these different engines than it has ever been in history. I mean, compared to 20, 30, 40 years ago, where you needed to know programming languages to even start. And now you can start at a relatively simple level. I mean, even something like playing in Minecraft, where you can play around with functions and systems and all of that, like a kind of, leveled up version of Lego, almost, I would say.
And this is so nice because it's so accessible. So there was this phase of making the game engines and the tools very available for everyone. So everyone also without programming knowledge can use this as a tool to be creative. So like also you, everyone who is listening right now could use a tool like Twine right after the podcast. Try out Twine and create your own first RPG, for instance. In this case, it would be text-based. This is like how you can create text adventures, but also it can be as powerful to create first tiny RPGs, and it just makes you creative and yeah, can be useful for so many other things outside of classical entertainment as well.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you about this potential and about also the beauty that's inherent in this, that, as you said, you can create things. And in that respect, I don't think there is an inherent difference in quality, especially between creating something in a game engine or writing something or painting something, making music. It's, you're not just recipient. You can create, you can build, you can play. But of course, I mean, there's also a darker side to games and especially the games industry, but also the communities in gaming. I don't want to dwell on this too much, but in your final part of the book, Reflect, you also talk about this. So for instance, we had Gamergate quite a few years ago, where basically you got toxic behavior, which was weaponized in gaming communities in extremely misogynist ways. But you also have the current state of the industry, where I think people who went into gaming because of what they wanted to create, and now basically it's becoming more and more difficult, especially in the AAA space. So where do you see the dangers in gaming? Where do they come from? How can you counteract them? And also, how do you deal with them? Because you're a gamer, you've been a gamer for a long time, but you're also a woman in a space which in many places is very toxic. What's your take on all of this?
That's a big question. and how to solve this, by the way. But let me start, for instance, with the last part. So I'm not going to lie, like being a woman in very often male-dominated places is still very difficult sometimes. So there's going to be a ton of people who are super supportive, who are really nice. But there will be always this one person who does not want you in his space. And this, of course, is also true in the internet and in virtual spaces like video games, which don't really necessarily come with the standard rules and standard law we might think, as we know it from our real world. So it's sometimes a little bit difficult. So what do I do? To be honest, for me, every single negative experience I had in my life was important because I try to take those things and try to build, for instance, my research and my work around those things, make it a nicer space for the people who are coming past me. So every negative thing which happened to me, I just tried and tried to make it better. And that's why, like, yeah, of course, it's not nice that very moment if you experience those things. Just a tiny example. When it comes to toxicity in video games, of course, it still happens that you start a video game. And if you are being recognized as being a woman, there will be easily comments like, okay, go back to the stove, go back to the kitchen. What are you doing here? You cannot play at all, and so on and so forth. This is not only in games, it's also in social media in general. So what do you do? I do a lot of research on toxicity and recommender systems and group finding now in video games. So to make systems which are building more inclusive systems and help in that regard. So that's why, like everything we do in our research, we talked a little bit about this earlier. I really try to take the technology, also in general as a computer scientist, not only with a focus on games, but also with a focus on AI systems and so forth. And we always try to use those systems to make something useful, positive around that, which makes the world hopefully a little better and not worse. Does this make sense?
Absolutely. I think that's a very, very nice point on which to end this part of the conversation. Perhaps to finish the overall conversation we're having here. So your book is called The Game Is On, but sadly it's only out in German at the moment. Are there any other language releases planned or in the works?
So the audiobook was just released, but still in German. We are working on an English version, but there is no date yet. And there's going to be a Thai version rather soon. So we are preparing translations.
How did that come about, if I may ask?
I have no idea.
Well, I mean, perhaps the best thing is not to question it and just enjoy it. I think it's a very nice book. I really enjoyed reading it and I really enjoyed talking to you about it. So thank you very much, Johanna, for the conversation and for the book.
Thank you so much. It was such a lovely conversation and I really liked your train of thoughts. Things can and need to be a little bit more creative and playful. And so very interesting thoughts you added. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And as always, thank you very much to our audience. And we will be back before long with more Damn Fine Cups of Culture, Damn Fine Espressos. And in the meantime, have a good spring. Goodbye.